to oppress them with forced labor, and they built Pithom and Ramesses as store cities for Pharaoh. But the more they were oppressed, the more they multiplied and spread. So the Egyptians came to dread the Israelites and worked them ruthlessly. They made their lives bitter with harsh labor in brick and mortar and with all kinds of work in the fields. In all their harsh labor, the Egyptians worked them ruthlessly. The king of Egypt said to the Hebrew midwives, whose names were Shiphrah and Puah, "When you are helping the Hebrew woman during childbirth on the delivery stool, if you see that the baby is a boy, kill him. But if it's a girl, let her live." The midwives, however, feared God and did not do what the king of Egypt had told them to do. They let the boys live. Then the king of Egypt summoned the midwives and asked them, "Why have you done this? Why have you let the boys live?" The midwives answered Pharaoh, "Hebrew women are not like Egyptian women. They're vigorous and give birth before the midwife arrives." Clever, isn't it? Interestingly, after that little bit of subterfuge, we read that God was kind to the midwives, and the people increased and became even more numerous. And because the midwives feared God, he gave them families of their own. Then Pharaoh gave this order to all his people: "Every Hebrew boy that's born, you must throw into the Nile, but let every girl live." Now, a man of the tribe of Levi married a Levite woman, and she became pregnant and gave birth to a son. When she saw that he was a fine child, she hid him for 3 months. But when she could hide him no longer, she got a papyrus basket for him and coated it with tar and pitch. Then she placed the child in it and put it among the reeds along the bank of the Nile. His sister stood at a distance to see what would happen to him. Then Pharaoh's daughter went down to the Nile to bathe, and her attendants were walking along the riverbank. She saw the basket among the reeds and sent her female slave to get it. She opened it and saw the baby. He was crying, and she felt sorry for him. "This is one of the Hebrew babies," she said. Then his sister asked Pharaoh's daughter, "Shall I go and get one of the Hebrew women to nurse the baby for you?" "Yes, go," she answered. So the girl went and got the baby's mother. Pharaoh's daughter said to her, "Take this baby and nurse him for me, and I will pay you." That's a good deal, isn't it? Paid to bring up your own children. I think it's not before time that that was brought back, I think. It is, definitely. But isn't that amazing? So the woman took the baby and nursed him. And when the child grew older, she took him to Pharaoh's daughter, and he became her son. She named him Moses, saying, "I drew him out of the water," which is sort of what the name Moses means. So here we have the beginning of the book. I've skipped the first few verses, but the first few verses also paint this rather bleak picture of the way that God's people were living in Egypt at the time. They were living under the ruthless power of one of God's most implacable and intimidating enemies. The scholars are out as to which Pharaoh exactly, historically speaking, the one was who decreed that the children would be killed. But one of the favorites is this man, or this is an image of the man, Thutmose II, who died in 1497 BC. So the incidents we're talking about are about 1500-ish BC. And the Pharaoh, of course, was the absolute power in the land. He was viewed as a god. And what we see in the start of the book of Exodus is the beginnings of a power struggle, effectively between two gods. The god called Pharaoh, and the god who later in the book we will find has a name, and the name is Yahweh. We see this cosmic power struggle worked out between the president of Egypt, the prime minister, the leader, the political power in Egypt, and God himself. Interestingly, just as a little bit of an aside, the reason why the scholars are not sure about which pharaoh it was is because the Bible doesn't tell us. So interestingly, in this book, where the two great powers, Yahweh and Pharaoh, are fighting one another, we do know Yahweh's name. God has a name, but we never know Pharaoh's name. which is an interesting way of putting him down, putting him in his place. Yes, all right, so you may just believe me. And so it's this Pharaoh who is intimidated by the strength of the foreigners within his country. They were given safe refuge, if you remember, by one of his descendants under Joseph, and they were tolerated. They became shepherds up in the Nile Delta, up in northern Egypt, and they were enabled to live a freeish life, but the problem was that they kept multiplying. And eventually they became a threat. There's too many of these jolly foreigners around. That was the thought. We need to do something about them. They were so intimidated that they took really drastic measures, and Pharaoh gave the order, eventually, having failed to get the midwives to kill the baby boys, that all the baby boys born must be thrown into the Nile. The Nile itself was viewed as a god, so in a sense it was child sacrifice. It was throwing the babies of Israel into the hands of one of the gods of Egypt who would do away with them. It was a way of showing their power. Do you see that? That our gods can swallow your children. But also, it was a way of exterminating the Israelites. If you get rid of all the males, or indeed if you got rid of all the females, whichever way you went, but if you got rid of all the males, clearly the line would begin to die out. The less males there were around, the less Hebrews there would be around. And so it was a form of genocide. Let's wipe these people out. Totally intimidating. Pharaoh became the first in the Bible, or one of the first in the Bible, of the human face of the opposition that God's people face in every generation. Occasionally through the Bible, the opposition that God's people face and God's plans face takes a human face. Here it's Pharaoh. A little later in Israel's history, it's Nebuchadnezzar. Around Jesus' time, it's Herod. Later in the end of the New Testament, it's the emperors of Rome. That those people become sort of the epicenter of the challenge to God's authority to rule in his world. But they are not the problem. We know that from the New Testament, Paul tells us that we are in a conflict. God does have enemies. We sang that lovely song just now, and I do like the song, but it did make me think. When we sing the line, "You have no rival, you have no equal," I want to say, well, sort of, definitely. You definitely have no equal, but I'm not sure that God doesn't have rivals. In fact, I think the Bible teaches us the opposite, that he does have rivals. He does have those who want to run the world without any reference to him. But Paul tells us, doesn't he, that they are really not the problem. As evil and wicked as they are, whoever they might be, those that want to squash God's plans and people, Paul says we don't wrestle against flesh and blood. There's something going on behind the flesh and blood, which is our real enemy. And it's that real enemy that Pharaoh becomes the human face of. He becomes the human face of anti-God forces that become the cultural and political means that seek to eradicate God's people. I'm sorry if there's too many long words on there. At 6 o'clock this morning, that phrase seemed like a good idea, but I'm beginning to wonder what it was. But what I'm trying to say is that it's not always obvious what we're fighting against, but we're fighting against something real. That was Paul's point, wasn't it, in Ephesians. We do wrestle. There is a struggle. There is a battle. There is a war going on, not just for us, although we'll come to that in a minute, but for God's right to rule in this land, in this world, in this earth. And if we don't really understand that when we're called to Christ, we're called to war, we will constantly be surprised and disappointed by the way that our lives pan out. Because we're called to war. And as Israel discovered in the very opening of Exodus, being God's family means there will be an enemy. You don't go looking for them, you don't choose them, you don't want them, but there will be someone else. There's something else going on still now. We can't say, well, we live the other side of the cross of Jesus, and that's when all the powers were defeated. It was after the cross of Jesus that Paul says we still are fighting a war. It was after the cross of Jesus that John wrote the book of Revelation, where he said, "Woe to you who live on the earth in these days, for Satan has been thrown down to you, and he knows his time is short." There's still an enemy. There's still an opposition to those of us that are God's people. And it's often worked out against the weakest and the most vulnerable. Did you notice that how Pharaoh tried to do it was he didn't go after the men, he didn't go after those of fighting age, he didn't go after households, he went after the children. And my concern, and I'm sure many of your concern, for our children and our grandchildren is that we are fighting the fight for them. That we are aware that there are anti-God forces, and I don't want to be sensationalist about this, but I do believe with all my heart this is the biblical reality. There are anti-God forces that want to snatch away the next generation of God's people. And that's been true in every generation, but I think it's especially true today. And culture is not neutral. Whether it's adult culture, youth culture, pop culture, whatever culture, it's not neutral. There are handles on the levers of power, and they're not godly hands. There are people who are not trying to form our next generation as people who love God and love their neighbor as themselves. And if people are forming others, and that's not their goal, then they cannot be safe hands. So parents, grandparents, do all you can to disciple your children. Do all you can. Parents, and by extension, grandparents, are the primary disciplers of the next generation. It's not those that work in the fantastic youth work we have here. They're doing backup work. We are the ones responsible. But listen carefully, in case you're thinking, oh, crumbs, I failed terribly. We're not the one responsible for outcomes. We're the ones responsible for inputs. None of us know how our children or grandchildren are going to grow up. They will make their own choices along the way. But our job as parents and grandparents is to give as best inputs as we can give to try and make sure that they think Jesus is utterly wonderful, that following Jesus is absolutely the best thing to do, that the best and wise and good life is defined by him and no one else. And if we can do all we can, then we've done our bit, whatever the outcomes happen to be down the road. Myrtle and I pray most days for our grandchildren and for our children. And that's just really what we pray some days. It's just, Lord, protect them. They live in a battle zone. Satan, like Pharaoh, doesn't fight clean. He goes after the youngest and the weakest and the most vulnerable. God has an intimidating enemy. That's where the book starts. Doesn't sound very great, does it? You know, it's not one of those things where you think, let's start with a great affirmation of God at the beginning of this story. No, actually, the affirmation is of the reality of God's enemy and the oppression that he brings on God's people. In fact, God is almost entirely absent from the first two chapters of Exodus. The only reference to God is the one that we read earlier, where the Hebrew midwives feared God, and so they chose not to kill the Hebrew children. Apart from that, God does not appear as the character who's directing events. Later he does, certainly. The whole book of Exodus is set up to take us there. But we start with God seeming to be rather invisible and rather on mute. He doesn't seem to be the active driver of events. He becomes that, but he's not here. And I wonder how it felt, because Israel, remember, perhaps this is news to some of you, but remember if you can, that they've been there for four centuries. We don't turn from Genesis to Exodus next day. According to later in the book of Exodus, we've been told that about 400 years of life has gone on. Think back 400 years. Some of you can do that. Oh, sorry, that's okay. That was very rude, I'm sorry. But I didn't mean in your personal experience. I mean, think back to where we were in history. 400 years is a long time. A lot of water flows under the bridge. A lot of forgetting goes on. A lot of reordering of life goes on. 400 years on, it's clear that they still remembered they had a God. The Hebrew midwives feared God and didn't kill the Hebrew babies. But I wonder what they thought of that God. I wonder how they believed that God. I wonder if they could sing that song that we sang this morning about God's power and might and sovereignty. What was it? I can't remember the lines of it now. You have no, the other one. Andy, come on, you chose it. Can you remember? Are you listening? Are you awake? How great is our God? That's it. How great is our God? How great is our God? Yeah, I wonder if they could have sung that. Really, after 400 years of slavery and opposition, getting worse by the month. I wonder if they could have sung How Great Is Our God. I really would admire them if they could. But I got a feeling they might not have. done it with much conviction, even though they had a memory. And isn't that true that sometimes life takes us to that point where somehow we can't stop believing, but in fact, we also can't rejoice in the bigness and goodness of God? Something about our faith, our history, our background, our upbringing holds us in a sort of faith, but it's not the sort of faith that has high expectations of imminent deliverance by God. I don't know if you've ever read these words before, but sometimes we can get into a black place, can't we, where we believe, but God seems so distant. These words, "Lord my God, who am I that you should forsake me, the child of your love? And now I've become as the most hated one, the one you've thrown away as unwanted, unloved. I call, I cling, I want, and there's no one to answer, no one on whom I can cling. No, not one, alone. The darkness is so dark, and I am alone, unwanted, forsaken. The loneliness of the heart that wants love is unbearable." Those are strong words, aren't they? But clearly someone who has a faith, they're praying, but someone who feels that God is so distant. Do you recognize those words, anyone, where they might come from? Psalm 22. Well, they're like Psalm 22. My God, why have you forsaken me? Even Jesus himself had his moment of God forsakenness, feeling that. These actually are words of Mother Teresa. They were discovered after her death in her journals. And it shows that here's someone who faithfully was serving God in the most trying of circumstances, day in, day out, held up by all as a paragon of Christian excellence and virtue, and yet in her heart somehow felt the terrible absence of God. Strong words. In her reflection on it, she said, "I work with God-forsaken people. It's God's gift to me that I can understand how they feel." Now, that was her interpretation, whether we like that or not. That's how she reckoned with it. But when we get to that stage, and I say this because I know some of us are there, do get there, may get there, because it's human experience for many people. What do we do? Well, the first thing is we try to articulate, however imperfectly, prayers of longing and complaint. That's what the Israelites did. The Israelites continued to groan under their burden of slavery. That's the best they could do. They cried out for help, and their cry rose up to God, we're told later in the chapter, chapter 2. That somehow or other, the best prayer they could pray was not some nice, polished version of the Lord's Prayer, had they been able to do that, but it was just, "God, help!" The Psalms are full of those kinds of prayers. I know I keep banging on about the Psalms, and I will always do so as long as you give me a platform space here, because I just think they're so important to our spiritual health. They allow us to say things that we might not feel we've even got the right to say to God. "How long? Where are you? Where have you gone? How long are you going to hide your presence from me? As the deer pants for water, I'm longing after you, God, but you're not there. I feel like I'm in a wilderness place. You are my God, but I long for you." Get honest in our prayers is the first thing when we're in these black moments. Don't think we've got to get it right and be the perfect, polished Christian prayer. Just groan and moan and complain. Yeah, good. Well, if you're good at it, then you're on the first step. The second thing is to ponder. When we're in these black places, think, is there any evidence that it could ever be different to this? Is there any evidence that maybe this doesn't need to be the way things are? Interestingly, the story of the Exodus is used throughout the Old Testament to remind subsequent generations of God's people that God can do incredible things in the most adverse of circumstances. So in the book of Isaiah, for example, Isaiah writes, "This is what the Lord says, 'He who made a way through the sea, a path through the mighty waters, who drew out the chariots and horses, the army and reinforcements together, they lay there never to rise again, extinguished, suffered out, snuffed out like a wick.'" That's all the Exodus. Generations on, centuries on, Isaiah saying, think back to what God did when he took us through the sea. And then he says, so forget the former things. Don't dwell on the past. See, I'm doing a new thing. God's quite capable of doing a new thing. That's what the book of Exodus is telling us. God is quite capable of doing a new thing. He has done it in the past. Interestingly, and as a bit of an aside, so I need to keep an eye on time, I'm extemporizing a bit here, but did you notice that Moses' mum, it says she looked at him and he was a good-looking baby, so she decided to save him. Praise God, Moses wasn't ugly. Ugly baby? Nah, I'm not going to bother. Good looking baby? Oh, great, okay. But the language there, it takes us back to the account of Genesis in chapter 1, where God says, and it was good, and it was good, and it was good. Moses was a good baby. So there is a hint there that this is God doing something new for his people, a new act of creation, bringing his people out of slavery. The other hint, just again as an aside, is that there are only two places in the whole Bible where a particular word for an ark is used. One is in the story of Noah, who was in a boat covered in pitch, cast adrift on the sea. Here, it's the basket that Moses is put in, it's the same word, covered in pitch, cast adrift on the water. And in both cases, they were moments when God acted to do something new and to renew his people. So you have here in this incredible story lots of little linguistic clues which we can miss in when we read it in English versions. That clearly the book of Exodus is set up to say God is quite capable of bringing new beginnings. So when we're stuck in the old thing, ponder, think, reflect. God can do this. He's done it throughout history and he's done it right up to this present day. The third thing is if we're stuck in this black place, get some good friends. Just as, this is from the Message version, just as lotions and fragrance give sensual delight. Do you like that phrase? Bit of brute, you know? High karate. Remember that? Just as lotions and fragrance give sensual, a sweet friendship refreshes the soul. When we're in that black place, we need friends who can live in black places with us. Who don't try and cheer us up and jolly us up and say, never mind, it'll be all right tomorrow, and then move on. We need people that sit with us in the black place, and we know that because they love us, maybe God does. That's what friends communicate. They communicate the presence of God. And if this person can sit with me, knowing me at my worst at this moment, then maybe God can too. We need some good friends. The Hebrews had a clear sense of cultural identity. They knew that they needed one another. They belonged together. The line must not die out. The Hebrew midwives must not kill the Hebrew children because they needed one another if they were going to stay strong. And then this last little bit of advice is when we're like really down and struggling, it's easy to cave in and just to give up. But the Hebrew midwives show us that actually they pressed on. They were in this situation. They were in a situation where they wondered where God was present and what God was up to. And we were told, as I've referred to a couple of times, that they feared God and they didn't do what the king of Egypt had told them to do. They let the boys live. They made a costly decision. It could have cost them their jobs. It certainly could have lost them their lives, actually, defying Pharaoh and allowing these children to live. I don't blame them for coming up with a little bit of a smokescreen for why there were so many Hebrew boys around, because they could have lost everything. And again, in our culture today, there are people who are making daily choices in education, in healthcare. Shall I stay true to what I know the King of Kings wants me to do, or shall I yield to the Pharaoh that's currently in charge of the health service or the education philosophy of our country? Hard choices to be made, but they pressed on. They did what they could despite the apparent absence of God. So I hope you're feeling a little bit depressed by now, because I've talked about God's incredible enemy and God's absence, apparent absence, from the scene. But let me just finish by pointing out this great truth, that all of this is couched in early indications that despite everything, God may have a rival, but he certainly doesn't have an equal. God is actually still at work despite the hiddenness of his hand. Right back at the beginning of the Old Testament, the Bible, in fact, you know the creation story climaxes with, well, it doesn't quite climax, but day six, the creation of humankind, climaxes with day seven, of course, and God blessed humankind and said to them, be fruitful and multiply, fill the earth and subdue it. That's what God wanted. He wanted human beings that would go, multiply, spread around the earth. If you want one sentence that tells you what the whole Bible is about, which would save you an awful lot of reading, it's this: God intends to get a worldwide family of people who love him, love one another, and love his creation. That's the statements on the screen. That's what it starts with. That's what the whole process is about in between, including the redemption of the cross, where all things are suddenly reconciled back to the Father, and the end of the whole book, where God says, right, new heavens, new earth, where righteousness is at home, and I will dwell with my people. The whole Bible is about God wanting a worldwide family of people who love him, love one another, and love his creation. Yeah? Don't look surprised. It's all over the place. And this is the start of it. This is where we're going, creation, says God. This is the direction we're headed in. An earth full of God lovers and people lovers and planet lovers. Be fruitful, multiply, fill the earth, subdue it, look after it, develop it, bring out its riches. He repeats much the same thing after it had gone rather wrong through the Noah incident to Abraham. The Lord said to Abraham, go from your country, your kindred, your father's house to the land I will show you, and I will make of you a great nation. I'm going to fill your nation with people that love me and love one another and love the planet. How big's the nation going to be? Well, God brought Abraham outside his tent and said, look towards heaven and count the stars, if you're able to count them. That's a little bit of a joke from God there, I think, you know. Then he said to him, how big's your nation? That big. Humongous. That's how big your nation's going to be, Abraham. A great nation, a massive nation. Because God, having said at the beginning of the book that he's after a worldwide family of people that love him, love one another, and love the planet, he has not given up, despite the flood scenario and virtually wiping the whole of planet Earth clean. He's relaunched it all with Noah and then with Abraham. And even when Abraham's growing family got sucked into Egypt because of the famine crisis, and they ended up living in northeastern Egypt, up in the Fertile Crescent, up in the delta there, even though they were there, before they'd gone there, this is what God said to Jacob, or to Israel. God spoke to Israel in visions of the night and said, Jacob, Jacob. And he said, here I am. And he said, I am God, the God of your father. Do not be afraid to go down to Egypt, for I will make of you a great nation there. I myself will go down with you to Egypt, and I will also bring you up again. Isn't that fantastic? Isn't that amazing that God said, you're going to go into the most horrendous thing. You'll probably doubt that I'm there. You're going to be there for quite a while. But don't worry, go down. Because even in captivity, even in exile from where you really belong, you will become a great nation. And what's more, I'm not going to sit here and wait for you to come home. I will be with you there. Isn't that comfort that when we're in those black places, those places we think we don't belong, where we think that life has kind of escaped us, where God has given up on us, God said, no, A, I'm there. B, you might be there because I want you to be there. And C, I can bring you up from there. Tremendous. And so what we get in the reading that we had earlier, in case you missed it, are words that are drawn directly from Genesis 1. The Israelites were fruitful and prolific. They multiplied and grew exceedingly strong, so the land was filled with them. Be fruitful, fill the earth, God said. But the more they were oppressed, the more they multiplied and spread, so the Egyptians came to dread the Israelites. You see, in that place of apparent absence of God, in that place of oppression under the tyranny of world power at the time, they thrived. I don't know if you remember back in the 1980s, there was a Marxist dictator that took over Ethiopia and he banned all the Christians from meeting in churches. And so all the Christians had to scurry to find caves and hidden places to meet in. They demolished most of the churches, the church buildings at the time. And then after about 10 years or so, that dictator was overthrown and a more democratic rule or a more open, generous rule came into Ethiopia. And the Christians emerged, and they went back to the buildings to try and rebuild them, but they realized that actually now the buildings were too small because they had multiplied so much in adversity that actually the place they'd lived in previously no longer fitted them. It was Israel's thing, because God is not going to give up. He is going to build his family. It's much what Jesus said in Matthew 16. To Peter, I tell you, Peter, you're a rock, and I'm going to build my church, and the gates of Hades, or the gates of death, will not prevail against it. God has an unstoppable project. It is to rescue ordinary people like you and I from the shipwreck that we're capable of making of our own lives and calling us into his family, the family that is the family above all families, worshiping the name that is above all names. And one day, all people will bow the knee, willingly or unwillingly, to Jesus Christ. Some out of respect, some for judgment. Some will bow the knee for Jesus Christ because ultimately, this is the only show in town. This is where history is headed. That's what we believe as Christians. We're headed towards a final denouement where God says, enough. New creation, where I live with humankind, and everybody who loves him and whose name is written in the Lamb's Book of Life gets to share that eternal future with the sum of all beauty living amongst them. Well, it's supposed to be good news. I'm clearly not presenting it as very good news. But in a story that starts like this, with God's intimidating enemy, threatening the very existence of God's people, cruelly abusing them, and where God appears to be on mute, not really engaging with his people's needs, the core truth of Exodus, as we'll see when we go through, is that God's purposes are unstoppable. The God who appears absent suddenly becomes very present. The God who we're not too sure about suddenly has a name and jumps into life because his purposes are unstoppable. And I guess that gives everybody a choice, doesn't it? Do we want to be in on the unstoppable purposes of God? Is that where our life is linked and hooked? Or do we want to be in on Pharaoh's crowd that headed for destruction? That's what Jesus said. It's two roads to live. A narrow road that leads to life or a broad road that leads to destruction. Make your choice. One doesn't look very promising, but get somewhere. One looks very attractive, but get somewhere very negative. That's the choice of Pharaoh against God, the rival against the king.